This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor with Professor Jeffrey Roberts of the University of College Cork, also Emeritus Professor of History at the college, at the university, and a member of the Royal Irish Academy. We're discussing his new book, Stalin's Library, which is part archaeological discovery of these books written in or doodled in or crossed out with Stalin's direction, his pencil, his ever prominent pencil. So the library is scattered. There are many questions about where the books are, what he collected, what he didn't collect, what's missing. We're right now in post-revolution. Lenin died of a series of strokes, and he's gone in 1924. And Stalin, who sees himself as the inheritor, is not exactly profoundly challenged because he was good as general secretary. But he begins his consolidation. He has an opponent whose name is Leon Trotsky. All of these players are vivid 20th century personalities. We're following the library. And the professor takes us to 1925. The woman who was Lenin's librarian now becomes Stalin's librarian. And Professor, this is a marvelous list of what Stalin wanted his library to look like. How is there an organizing principle here? Why he detailed these subjects and then singled out these certain authors to be separate from the other subjects? How did he explain it to the librarian?
Yeah, well, as we were discussing earlier, you know, Stalin was a great admirer of Lenin, and he considered himself to be Lenin's disciple. So the thing about Lenin, for starters, Lenin was Stalin's role model, yeah? And the thing about Lenin was that he was an intellectual, but he was also a practical man of action. And Lenin was also a huge reader as well, of course, and he had a huge personal library, and he worked surrounded by books, yes? So to Lenin's very much Stalin's role model in relation to Stalin's library as well. The aspiration to build up a huge personal book collection. And that actually leads him, after Lenin's death, to employ the person who had been Lenin's personal librarian, a woman called Shushanika Manucharans, right, to organise his book collection, to actually help transform it into a definite personal library with an identity of its own. Okay, and it's Shushanika who says to Stalin, okay, I'm happy to organise your books for you, but you have to tell me how you want me to classify them. How do you want me to organise them? So she prompts him to compose this classification scheme, and he does that. It's a handwritten classification scheme. It's reproduced in the book completely. So what are his classifications? His classifications are the kind of classifications you'd expect to find in any kind of library, yeah, like subject classifications, like philosophy, psychology, economics, history, and so on, but also a series of other categories which are to do with his Marxist politics and to do with the history of revolutionary movements. But then there's a third aspect to this classification, which are the great Marxist thinkers that he wants their books to be kept separately so you can make special study of them. Okay, and it's no surprise when you find that the top of this list of great Marxists is Lenin, right? Lenin is Stalin's favorite author. Stalin reads more of Lenin's works than he does of anyone else. He marks, writes on more of Lenin's works than he does of anyone else. But the interesting thing that caught my eye when I looked at this was how high up the list Trotsky was. Yeah, Trotsky is number five in this list, ahead of other people, other Bolshevik leaders and intellectuals who were Stalin's allies, right? Okay, so that was very interesting to me. And what I discovered in the course of my research, that actually in this period, the period we're talking about, up until the mid-1920s, Stalin had a great deal of respect for Trotsky as an intellectual, as a Marxist, and spent a good deal of time reading Trotsky's works. And indeed, getting a lot out of it, positively. Now, Stalin was always read to learn, and he was willing to learn from anyone, from any source, including people like Trotsky, who later became his deadly foe.
It's important to talk about the legends at this point, Professor. I write down from one person's point of view that Stalin read 500 pages a day, which you say sounds impossible for anyone. Sometimes they said he read 300 pages a day. Were these legends in his own time, or is this reflection years later? Where did these numbers come from?
Well, Stalin was a very fast reader, and he had a phenomenal memory. Yeah? So he could have read 300, 400, 500 pages of this kind of reading today. I don't think he did, because I think he was too busy. Because we know what he was reading on a daily basis, because we have access to all these documents from his personal archive. So given Stalin's workload, the paperwork he had to deal with as general secretary, I don't think it's possible that he could have read that much on a daily basis. You know, maybe when he was on holiday or something like that. So I think that they are kind of legends. They're retrospective legends. Yeah, but having said that, during his lifetime, Stalin's identity, part of the cult of Stalin as an individual, was that he was a great intellectual, that he was a great reader, that he was kind of like a Renaissance man. They had all this kind of knowledge. He was often depicted, standing in front of bookcases or books or reading or studying books and stuff like that. So the idea that Stalin was a serious intellectual and an engaged reader, read a lot of books, so that was something that was prevalent at the time. That's not a post hoc invention.
Publishing was also critical, not only to the Bolsheviks — they called themselves Bolsheviks at this time, not communists, Bolsheviks — but also to Stalin. They took over the publishing industry. I'm trying to think of a modern analogy for this, Professor. Is this like becoming a social media website? They took over. They were the, you know, the Microsoft and Facebook and Google of their times. They're thinking, because they dominated publishing. Here today, I'll speak for America because I'm a recovering novelist. I'll speak for America. Publishing is not a big business here. It is a specialty for those who have the leisure, the time, the education, and the luck to be able to indulge fiction and nonfiction and history books. But the way this is presented is that it became one of the fundamental industries for the Bolsheviks to what? What was Stalin's thinking of this massive takeover and these huge print runs?
Well, one of the first things the Bolsheviks did when they gained power after the revolution, and after the Civil War as well, was that they took control of publishers and printers, and also libraries, because they wanted to control, you know, what people read. Now, they wanted people to read, because for the Bolsheviks, reading was the route through to human liberation and emancipation. I mean, going back to Stalin as a young man, what was it that transformed his life, yeah? Changed his life, yes? It was reading books, right? So, Stalin and the Bolsheviks, they want everyone to go through the process that they themselves are capable of, but they want to control that reading, because they're fearful that people might read the wrong books, yes? So as well as, like, you know, the taking control of the publishing, printers, libraries, and also actually encouraging people to read, to learn to read, developing programs of mass literacy, they also institute a very rigorous system of censorship to actually control, you know, what books are printed, what books end up in public libraries, and what books are people able to read. So the Bolsheviks aimed at what they thought was a reading revolution, right? A revolution which they thought would be a revolution of the mind, but transform not just human consciousness, but human nature. So you can see, you know, the whole reading aspect of the Bolshevik Revolution, the libraries, the books, the printers, actually absolutely central to what's going on.
Stalin also is keen not only on reading and writing, we've talked about that, but he's keen on presenting the correct face of his party, the Bolshevik Party, and also the correct face of what he finds importance. And what he does is he takes a stamp, an ex libris stamp, and has it put in certain books, but not all books, because you say many of the books found in his library or identified later as his library, he borrowed and failed to return. So what was his thinking about that stamp that he had put in his book? Were those special when it said from the library of Stalin?
Okay, well, let's go back to Lenin again. Yeah, okay. Lenin had his ex libris stamp, yeah, which said his books were stamped saying it belonged to him, right? And I believe that that work stamp was devised by his librarian, Shushanika Manutrans. So when she goes to work for Stalin, she does the same thing. She devises an ex libris stamp, which identifies these books as belonging to Stalin personally and his library. And that stamp actually looks very similar. It's the same kind of stamp as Lenin's stamp. So I think this is Shushanika's idea. And she's the one who stamps the books that he has in his possession at the time. And she's the one who numbers those books. Okay, and what happens is Shushanika only works for Stalin for a few months, and then she goes on to other projects, right? But the system she set up, whereby books coming into Stalin's office or into his apartment or whatever are stamped, that system continues until the early 1930s. And so by the early 1930s, there's about 5,000 or so of stamped books with this extra. And it's that collection of books that survives Stalin's death. Because what happens after Stalin dies is that, okay, the initial plan is to retain his book collection intact, just as they'd done with Lenin's book collection. But then Khrushchev denounces Stalin at the 20th Party Congress as a brutal, terroristic dictator. And after that Party Congress, 1956, decisions are taken to disperse Stalin's personal effects, including his book collection. So the vast majority of his books, and I estimate there's about 25,000 texts by the time he dies, are dispersed to other libraries. They're given to other libraries. They disappear onto other shelves. But there's about 5,500 books that have his stamp, or he marked in some way or identified it belonging to him. They're retained by the archivists of the Communist Party. And that's that remnant of his library that forms the basis for my research in this book.
Between 1925 and moving to the dacha, meaning nearby, in 1934, the books are in different places, and I want to picture them. He has an office in the Kremlin. He has an apartment nearby or right below his office. Are there books, library books that he keeps in his office, library books that he keeps in his apartment, library books that he keeps in the first dacha, the family dacha?
There are books wherever Stalin works and lives. Everywhere. Books are a constant kind of accompaniment. His daughter Svetlana complained that there was no room on the walls of their apartment in the Kremlin because they were just full of bookshelves. Stalin had a dacha, another dacha in the 1920s, and that had a room with wall to ceiling bookcases in it as well. Yeah, his office, and his apartment wall was overflowing with books. In a way, that's why he brought in Lenin's librarian to help him, and his wife as well, to help him put some kind of order on this sprawling collection of books. Because the thing to remember is that Stalin wasn't a bibliophile. He didn't love books as kind of like physical or aesthetic objects, right? He loved books. He loved reading, but he loved them through ideas, for their information. So his library was his personal working archive. Yeah. So from Stalin's point of view, the fact that it sprawled over, his apartment and where his various workspaces, but that was kind of natural situation.
We're going to turn to a tragedy next that changes the nature of Stalin's thinking, if not his library. The book is Stalin's Library. Professor Jeffrey Roberts is the author, a dictator in his books. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
The devastating effects of climate change are real, creating new challenges for home and business owners. But there's hope and opportunities to adapt and become more resilient. Here in Connecticut, we've launched Energy Storage Solutions, a program that incentivizes Eversource and UI customers to install batteries in their homes and businesses. So, the next time a major storm hits, you'll have backup if the power goes out. Learn more by visiting energystoragect.com. The devastating effects of climate change are real, creating new challenges for home and business owners. But there's hope and opportunities to adapt and become more resilient. Here in Connecticut, we've launched Energy Storage Solutions, a program that incentivizes Eversource and UI customers to install batteries in their homes and businesses. So, the next time a major storm hits, you'll have backup if the power goes out. Learn more by visiting energystoragect.com.